We knew the economy was going to turn at some point, but you never really can be prepared for timing or speed of change.
I hope this cycle we're in doesn't take us back to the days of regulatory purgatory, where everything we did had consequences.
As the world continues to change, we have found out we need to be even more nimble as we move forward.
By requiring things like business continuity planning and pandemic plans, we need to think proactively about what we need to do in the future.
We better grab our helmets and start getting prepared today.
Banking is a risk business, but in today's environment, we are being faced with uncertain times. Financial institutions have always had partners who could help evaluate, address, and mitigate risk. But today, they need to lean on those partners more than ever. Welcome to Bank on Whitfleet. Each episode will feature discussions around industry issues, hot topics, and current trends, giving you an insider's look at how top performers and professionals are staying ahead of the curve. All right, let's get into today's conversation.
Hello, this is Robert Zondag, Senior Manager with the Strategic Advisory Team for Whitfleet's financial services industry and host of the Bank on Whitfleet podcast. Today's guest is Dr. Stephen Buckman of Clemson University. Dr. Buckman is a professor in the Master of Real Estate Development program at Clemson. Dr. Buckman, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Robert.
We're excited to talk with you about the commercial real estate market and, of course, the trends that we anticipate happening in the next several years. Our financial institutions and lenders certainly have a significant interest in the commercial real estate market and certainly in commercial real estate development, given their lending and commercial portfolios. Could you provide our listeners some information about your background and your role at Clemson?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So I've worked in the private and public sector before I went into the academy. So I worked briefly for City of Glendale, Arizona's Community Revitalization Department. And then from there, I moved on to working in development with Trammell Crow doing office development. I was there for a little while and then took off to start my own firm, which I was with for a bit, and then morphed into commercial brokerage, where I did both investment and then, you know, this was all around that 08, 09, 10 area where we were all getting kind of hammered.
So I remember those days fondly.
It was a brutal time. I mean, our little development firm took it on the hit, so hence why I went into commercial. But I did investment at first when you could do investment, and then it was land and retail. And then, you know, basically because of that kind of economic flu hitting everyone, I said, let's go back and finish that PhD. So I went back and finished my PhD at Arizona State, and I taught at University of South Florida for a little while at a postdoc at Michigan. And now I teach in the Master's of Real Estate Development program here at Clemson. And I continue to do consulting to developers, a lot of stuff on kind of land use, kind of changes, zoning changes, putting together those type of reports. And as well as doing my own work. So I'm doing a development in Jacksonville with a partner, which is about a 28-unit townhouse complex we're putting together. So that's kind of my background. And then I'll tell you a little bit of, you know, the real estate program here at Clemson, we are very practitioner driven. So we really teach our students, you know, how to do a development instead of kind of being more esoteric and hedonic modeling and these kind of things. So a lot of our students go right into brokerage. A lot of them fall into brokerage on the office, industrials. Everybody wants to go in industrial, especially up here in Greenville, South Carolina area, and into kind of just development, being development managers, that type of thing, and analysts. So.
Well, I know the program's very well regarded, certainly with your background as a practitioner and in the industry, makes an impact on your students. So we appreciate you carving out the time today to talk to us.
Well, I hope it makes an impact on them. Let's put it that way. Some maybe negatively, but they just had their first test of the semester, and so some aren't liking me as much as they used to.
Well, that's probably the case. You know, Dr. Buckman, maybe let's start with a brief overview of what you see as current trends in commercial real estate. What should our lenders and banks be thinking about? You know, some insights there would be fantastic.
Yeah, you know, this is so asset kind of based and regionally based of where you're at. Right now, you know, especially up here in, and you know, I'm down here in Greenville, South Carolina. We have the, you know, 26 and 85 connection. And, you know, we are an industrial powerhouse right now. You cannot put up industrial fast enough, right? And it's, you know, we it's kind of a joke that, you know, one of the industrial friend of mine, his broker, is like, this is C student work, you know? It's boring. You put up a million square foot with 40-foot, 5-foot bays, and you get it out there. They're not being picked up fast. I mean, they are just immediately come out of the ground. They're being picked up, and these guys are making all kinds of money. So, you know, industrial is going to be huge, and industrial will continue to be big in places like where I am in the Southeast, and these kind of regional kind of places, as well as, I think, you know, staying in the industrial component, what I think you're going to start to see, and we're already starting to see this, and it's hard to find these sites a little bit, is that last mile. That last mile site is going to be key. You know, you get your Amazons and all these things where we order our Amazon and we expect it in 24 hours on our Amazon Prime. Well, you know, they have to be somewhere, so they'll be delivered, and, you know, within that last mile. So that is a big thing that's starting to take off. And you see these last mile places happening in these kind of old historic industrial sites within cities, right? So that is a big kind of growing trend in the industrial. Nobody here foresees the industrial going away anytime soon. You know what? And it's going to sound like a little bit of a, I'm going to contradict myself in a little bit in a way, but, you know, during COVID, we got so used to these bigger kind of items, TVs, things like this, that we could buy just online and be to us immediately. And that was always, we all knew, was a trend that was going in that direction anyways. And then it just went on steroids, right? Full steroids with COVID. And so that is going to very much continue. We kind of let the proverbial kind of rabbit out of the box thing, right? Where now it's on the leash. So, you know, industrial is going to continue to be hot, and especially in regions where taxes are low, like the Southeast, and where, you know, labor is needed, and you can get labor cheaper. You know, I kind of hate to say it, but non-union states are really kind of seeing this huge growth because they can open these shops, open these industrial sites, and you know, pay labor a wage that, you know, we'll have to pay much more of maybe in the Northeast. So that's one. You know, as far as office, I mean, we can make that guess you'd win the Nobel, because right now nobody quite has figured out what office is going to become, and it hasn't quite ferreted itself out yet on what it will look like. You know, you can go to like a ULI conference where I was just recently at and get that question asked to somebody and get three different answers from three different people. So nobody quite knows. And of course, you know, downtown office cores right now will have a heavily impact on retail. But, you know, more and more of the companies are starting to want their employees back in the office, right? Now, I am not a believer that they're going to go back in the office full time. Again, that is another Pandora that's been released, right?
I think that genie is out of the bottle.
Yeah, exactly. And you're going to see, I think, on the office side, 2-3 days a week type of thing. So what does that mean to commercial office? You know, there's a lot of debate out there what that's going to mean. Are firms that had a big floor plate going to cut that floor plate in half because they don't need as many people? Or are they going to, you know, keep that same floor plate, demand lower rents, which will probably be the case, anyway you cut it, but have that floor plate and gone, you know, are they going to go away from this bullpen kind of structure that offices become to be more privatized offices in this age of COVID, which is going to linger with us for quite a while, to have this social distance and stuff. So nobody quite understands it. Now, I don't think anybody, you know, you go to a ULI or one of these kind of events and people are still bullish, right? They're very much bullish on the fact that office will retain. I personally do think the Jamie Dimons of the world and so forth are forcing their people back in. And that, you know, office is not going to go away. It's going to change. And I, you know, there's going to be demand for lower rents. And I think there's also going to be a demand for more amenities within the office space, right? Not the standard kind of go in, you know, have your little tiny break room with your bad coffee and whatnot, but actually have amenities that, you know, we all kind of scoffed at 10 years ago and wish we had with, like, you know, Microsoft and Apple and all of these kind of things where they'd have, you know, bean bags and ping pong tables and things like this. But I think that's probably going to be kind of more of the trend to draw some of those younger people back in the office. Now,
go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, so really when we're thinking about who we're lending to or the type of developer, probably a developer that is able to withstand changes or pressure on the amount that they can receive from rent in an office building. And real quick, you had touched a little bit on the industrial nature of not only thinking of lending to people who are going to develop raw land, but also in metro areas where the distributor needs to be to reach the maximum amount of the population. So we might look at industrial development from fresh eyes. Is that two of the things I'm hearing you say?
I think you see industrial in two ways, Rob. That's a good question. One is you have this virgin land that you'll just develop in, right? I look at some places up here like Duncan, South Carolina, or Commerce, Georgia, right? They're just throwing them down. They have that land. But, you know, you're still going to want to have some of these, call it just in time, if you will, delivery centers, that last mile. That is always the problem with industrials, that last mile, right? And so these smaller kind of warehouse spaces that are in cities themselves, especially denser ones where it's harder to get in and out of, where you have that, right? Where you can be like, okay, you know, 2-day delivery, we'll drop it off at 2 a.m. at this site, then it can be easily picked up. And what's a lot of, we're seeing this already, and we see this a lot at the holidays, right? You have this expansion of small scale delivery people, right? That are delivering out of U-Haul rental vans and things like this, right? And that's what I think is going to happen. So, but most of those are not going to be new builds. Those are going to be rehab, right? Maybe historical old warehouse structures that they're going to be reconfigured to be this kind of deal. So that's, you know, I see that happening quite a bit, and that's still kind of a thorn in the side and how to make that happen. But that is something that's going to blow up, in our opinion, at least. What I think the office people that are going to most survive are those that make these amenity shifts. Because we're, you know, I sound like an old fogey, but you know, younger guys coming in, you know, in their 20s and 30s, and I see with my students, you know, they're not built for this traditional office world, right? They want the little ping pong. They want the, you know, the nice coffee stations and all of these kind of things. They want much more freedom and, you know, control of their own kind of worlds. And now those are the ones I think are going to win out. These offices that have more amenities, and those are the ones that are going to be most appealing to businesses to shift to and move to. So, you know, that space they may be giving up, which they can't necessarily rent in an amenity space, right? That dead space will actually be able for them to maybe drive their rents up a little bit.
It sounds like using the office space really as an engagement tool for employees and a recruitment or attraction tool needs to be considered.
You're dead on. That's exactly it. Because that's going to be part of the you know, employees, future employees arsenal, right? Like, you know, there's very much, and I see this with kids, you know, in their 20s, who I teach, it's, you know, I am a stud, I am the guy, you know, you want me, you know, I don't want you kind of thing. And so prove to me why I should go to work for you, right? And, okay. You know, with, you know, this whole kind of thing that's happening now with people resigning, labor is getting much more of a control, and, you know, high grade white collar label is getting a lot of control too. So I think those are the ones that are going to start to win out. Now, you know, other asset class with multifamily. I mean, multifamily is just absolutely kind of blowing up, right? You know, multifamily is going up everywhere. And
we hear there's not enough inventory, and that's what you mean by blowing up, correct?
Yeah, well, there's not enough inventory. So you see cranes all over the place putting up multifamily, right? So, you know, a lot of these are mixed use, but, you know, you're looking at something right now where, you know, it's becoming more and more difficult to purchase a home. And a lot of people that are in their 20s and early 30s are actually just giving up on the idea, right? Like, why bother? And going into multifamily. And it's this kind of move back to the city thing, which has been going on for the last 20 years or so, you know? And you can see this where you're at, Robert, in Milwaukee, right? There's the shift to the Third Ward and all of this growth of the downtown core. And you're getting that a lot of places that people want that. And so the multifamily, rental multifamily is blowing up. And one thing beyond that is becoming very, very interesting, and it's really in its infancy, is for rent home developments. These are starting to pop up, and they just really started, you know, beginning, I'd say, of the COVID era in the last 2 years or so, you know, the Pulte's, the Lennars of the world, big master plan developers would normally do, you know, 7,500, 150 unit single family homes that they look to sell, right? They put their little sales shack out front. You go and you look at some models, you buy your home, right? Sure. Well, now what we're seeing the shift is that they're doing that same thing, but they have no intention to sell any of those homes. They're now being rented, purely built for rental. And this is starting, there's a lot of this that is starting to go on. And I think that is part of the, and I use that as multifamily because in a sense it is multifamily. It's a very similar pro forma if you were to build a pro forma for a multifamily apartment than you would for this, right? Because yes, they're all single entities, but they almost are like units when you look at a pro forma per se, right?
And so we need to look, the lender needs to look at it just like a rental building, you're saying, with kind of that long-term cash flow basis.
Absolutely.
And the ability to look at long-term financing versus the bridge or short-term financing if it were a home development situation, is what I hear you saying, Dr. Buffin.
Yeah, agreed 100%. I mean, you're going to look at this if you're a lender and you're underwriting this as, you know, I would look at it as a multifamily, right? I would look at it as a multifamily development that's horizontal instead of vertical, right? And, you know, you're looking at maybe, you know, 150 units that are all for sale. And, you know, they have an HOA like, you know, a multifamily would have. That HOA, you know, is either on top of their rent or embedded into their rent. You know, that HOA covers, you know, the rec center, the pool, you know, the all of the other kind of things you would see. And they would have no different look than it would be a regular kind of community. And there's a shift to that, too, for a few reasons. One, we just talked about, you know, it's becoming so hard to buy a home, right? And we could talk about all the reasons why, you know, reduced rates and artificially reduced interest rates, all these kind of things, right? And, you know, so, and also, you know, people are moving so much more, right? They're going to a, you know, let's, you know, honey, let's take this job in Boise, right? From Denver. And they go there for a couple of years, they're like, but they're not willing to buy something yet, but they have a couple of kids, you know, they got the dog, they got the picket fence, and they want a home, but they want a nice home. They don't want to deal with, like, you know, this kind of the slumlord single family home kind of thing that's one-offs. And, you know, when you go to a Pulte or a Lennar or something, you know you're getting a certain product and you know you're getting a strong management style, right? Just like if you get a multifamily from, let's say, Graystar or Trammell or the Beach Company or East West or whatever, you know you're getting that kind of same background. And people are starting to really like that. And so, like I said, this is just in its infancy, but this is something that it got a lot of our little ears pricked up to be very kind of like, what's happening? And this is something that I think is going to be exceptionally interesting on the multifamily front.
I would say that is very much a new concept. A lot of it driven, like you said, by lifestyle changes of the people that would be the target audience. Something I think for our listeners to really consider when they think about kind of multifamily financing, because it is going to be a much different structure potentially than if you were building a large apartment building.
Yeah. And, you know, you're not sharing walls, you're not doing that kind of stuff, but, you know, you're going to get a blanket, basically insurance policy like you would, you know, if you had a multifamily, right? You're going to all of these kind of structures and they're all going to basically look the same. So you're going to have that, you know, construction loan that's, you know, all going to kind of be the same. They'll probably be, you know, just like you would have in a multifamily, you know, studio, one bedroom, two bedroom, three bedroom. So you might have it, you know, three bedroom, four bedroom. Maybe this one is Dutch colonial and this one is whatever, right? But, you know, it's going to have a very similar structure. And it's, there's a few that are starting to do this. And people are, like I said, very, very interested. And as you just pointed out, Robert, that it's a changing demographic, it's a changing way of seeing, you know, societal shifts. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people also that don't, you know, kind of harboring back to what I said a little while ago, don't see this everybody being able to work from home forever being a reality, right? So let's get in this area where we want to be, but let's not sell our home back in Denver. Let's just rent this one in Boise. And if things go south or they want us back in the office, well, we'll go back, right? That kind of thing.
Let's pivot a little and let's talk a little bit about kind of, I know what everyone's been thinking about, the future of retail. So we've talked about industrial, we've talked about multifamily. Let's have a little discussion on where we think retail's going, because boy, that has changed not only from the pandemic, but really before that, and maybe some of that pressure you were talking about in the industrial space. Mm-hmm. What's going on in retail? What do you see? What should our listeners know?
Yeah, retail. Wow. So, you know, retail is an interesting animal in the sense of, you know, people were calling retail dead before the pandemic, and now retail might be more dead. But in some parts of retail, and I'll explain that, you know, these kind of strip malls are dying on the vine. And what the retail now, I think, that is surviving is not just the one kind of pony shop, right? It's a lifestyle kind of center. It's multiple things happening in the same space. You know, Robert, we can use Marn, for example, where in Milwaukee, where, you know, they've constructed a space with a small retail in it, with the wine and coffee, with an artist gallery, with a space that you can rent for conferences, for conference room space, right?
Real quick for our listeners, Marn is an artist hub that is in downtown Milwaukee, and to Dr. Buckman's point, really a multi-purpose retail environment, I guess. Is that the best way to describe it for our listeners?
That's exactly, and I think those are the ones that are starting to become the most successful. I think, you know, the big boxes are kind of a bit dying on the vine because they're soulless, right? And the retail that is surviving and it's going to be more on a survival mechanism, of course, are going to be your restaurants and those type of endeavors, right? And, you know, there's always going to be those that are going to get their DoorDash, get their food delivered. But I don't know about you, Robert, but one of the things I missed during the pandemic was going out to eat, right? I like to go to eat and go have a, you know, cocktail somewhere and all of these kind of things. You know, these experience places, right, are going to continue to thrive. The small retail, and I've done quite a bit of kind of work on looking at local first organizations as a form of economic kind of resiliency. And, you know, we could probably, everyone on this, listening to this and talking to, can remember, you know, 15 years ago when they were all saying, you know, when Amazon was starting to pop up, that the independent bookstore was dead, right? It's dead. It will no longer exist. What you see has happened is maybe the Barnes and Nobles of the world have contracted, and those independent ones took a huge hit, right? But they're starting to pop back up, but they're starting to help.
You know, it's so interesting you said that. I was listening to economic forecast, but actual books this year are up 15 to 18% in sales. It correlates exactly to what you're saying, is this kind of lifestyle choice retail, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, and books are, you know, I use the book example because they're a perfect example. One, on the actual physical, you know, everybody's like, oh, A, we're not gonna need bookstores because we're not gonna buy physical books. Well, that was dead wrong, right? Because I think what people figured out is that we like books, right? We like to be able to crunch that and put it in our back pocket. And it is, in a sense, you know, not to sound vain, but you're sitting at the bar or the coffee shop and you're reading, you know, you're reading a certain book, and people can kind of, you're, in a sense, you're kind of showing yourself off. Like, look at me read Dostoevsky, right? Like, look how smart I am, or whatever.
Or right? Maybe we could say a better word. You're inviting people to have a conversation with you, Dr. Buckman.
There you go. Yes, inviting people to have a conversation. Yeah. So, you know, there is that. But also, I think people really like that tactile feel of books. I mean, just on a kind of going out there a little bit, but the bookstore itself, right? You know, you get on your Amazon, and we all do Amazon, and nobody's saying, like, in a local first small retail to go away from the Amazons of the world. That will never happen, right? You know, local first organizations talk about, if you can ship just 10% of your buying income to local or the local stuff, the impact would be astronomical, right? And that's just 10%, right? But what we're seeing with, like, bookstores, or Crystal Clear Examples, are becoming, local bookstores are becoming neighborhood centers, right? You know, we can have all these debates about the loss of kind of the neighborhood feel, but, you know, it's places where you can go to and you see the same bookseller and they know the books you read. They're like, hey, you know, Robert, I know you really liked, you know, that last book you read. What about this new author? It's something you would never look at, right? And oftentimes they're having coffee shops in it. So is this mix of uses in one space. And I think one of the things, and this is an argument I made in a paper I wrote, that, you know, during COVID, we were so homebound, but when the kind of drop where we could go out a little bit, and our world all of a sudden became very small, right? And we took a greater sense of our neighborhoods and the neighborhood kind of stores and these kind of more small mom and pop things. So I think that end of the retail is going to will thrive and continue to thrive. These bigger box things, the Targets, these things, you know, they're having, I think they're going to have this harder time, and they've all kind of starting to shift to this Amazon model where you can, you know, buy stuff and just go pick it up or it will be delivered. And so, you know, those I think will kind of contract a tad. And, you know, one other point on that is that, you know, these smaller retail things during the pandemic were able to shift a lot quicker, right? You had, you know, small restaurants, small boutiques that shifted a lot quicker to being able to deliver product, you know, to someone's home and all of these kind of things. Then, you know, it's kind of like moving a speedboat versus moving a tanker, right? And the Targets and the Walmarts were moving tankers, right? To try and so the nimbleness of the small business, I think, will bode well in an era that we're in where I personally don't think, you know, COVID will be the last kind of pandemic we go through. We'll be in an age of, you know, things that will shock our system that are not, you know, economic based per se, but are climate based and are, you know, these types that we, from an economic perspective, be nimble with.
Yeah, and what I think, what aligns with what you're saying in the work we do with many of our financial institutions is, one, this idea of hyper-personalization and that retail operations affecting commercial real estate or retail space really have to be companies or organizations that can have kind of a hyper-personalization experience to the people that choose to go there versus ordering it online. And then I think the second is that, like you said, there has to be a thought if you're a lender in this space of looking at who's ultimately going to rent it and is a part of an omni-channel delivery organization where there's going to be some type of digital presence along with the retail experience. So that's what we're seeing, I think, in the work we're doing.
Yeah, and you'll see, you know, some of the retail things that are also becoming quite popular are these shops that are not even in the business of selling something, right? In the sense of what I mean by that, they are tied with an online merchant, right? You go into that shop to try on the shirt you saw online, then you will buy it online, right? Or to actually see it. And so those are, you know, that in itself is interesting when the shop itself is not designed to actually sell the product. The shop itself is there to have you go and touch and feel the product and to put it on to see if, you know, it looks good on you or whatever that may be, right?
Excellent. Well, let's pivot a little bit because I certainly want to be cognizant of the areas that we discuss. What about affordable housing? Some of our lenders are in that space. Certainly a lot of talk about affordable housing when we talk about the multifamily. What's happening in the affordable housing market?
Well, you know, you're seeing, you know, everywhere, you know, we already touched upon this, the need for affordable housing and what that kind of constitutes. Now, the trick is to, I guess it's not a trick per se, is to talk developers into doing affordable housing, right? And that's where the rubber is kind of hitting the road. But you're seeing, you know, LIHTC, you know, I think I'm one of those that believes that there's going to be kind of some changes in the way LIHTC is structured, low-income housing tax credits, because, you know, that in and of itself starts gentrification. The opportunity zone models right now that are popping up, you know, that's pretty new. Last 3 years ago, it was out of the tax code. And one of, you know, President Trump's greatest kind of things he looked at during his presidency, you know, is going to help reshape kind of disenfranchised communities with, you know, new housing and bring developers in there. But it is a need. And, you know, and one of the things with developers, they're not going to do it unless they're forced to. And that sounds kind of bleak, but it's true in the same sense, right? And developers in and of themselves are pack animals. It's hard to put their neck out. And it's hard to put their neck out, you know, because, you know, funders are less likely to fund things that are a little more radical, right? Or a little bit more out there. So, you know, on the affordable side, inclusionary zoning by communities that forces them to do certain amounts of in their developments are going to kind of, I think, start popping up more and more. And you know, we have gone away from the Pruitt-Igos and Cabrini-Greens of the world of these mass kind of developments of affordable or workforce housing. Instead, it's a mix, right? So it's a LIHTC building of, you know, 20% of your building is, you know, is low-income housing, right? Or workforce, where you get your credit, right? You get your low-income housing tax credit, you put it in there, and you're able to offset those losses you would take from not having to be market. But you have this mix of market rate and workforce slash low-income housing that is making this work. And that's kind of really where all affordable affordable workforce housing is going to.
So lenders should be aware that it's not necessarily going to be an entire building of affordable housing, but really thinking about a mixed demographic. Is that the best word?
Right. Okay. So, you know, you would have, you know, if you were to look at your budget pro forma, you know, let's say just theoretically 100 unit complex, you'd have, you know, 80 market rate at $2,000 a pop, and then you're going to get 20, you know, low-income housing credits, low-income housing spots that, you know, will be at $1,200 a pop. But to make that pro forma work, they would get, you know, that equity that they sold their tax credits for and dump it in. So that shows up, will show up as an equity line to help this development off. So to show that they will be able to make, you know, their income ratios and all these kind of things and their ROIs at the end of the day. But those are, you know, 15-year marks, and those pull down, roll out. And so there, I think there is going to be some change to that. But yes, when your lenders here are looking at that, they're going to be looking at a model that's, you know, structured where, you know, like I said, 80% of that development is market rate and their 20 is low income, but they're getting those credits from somewhere. You know, usually LIHTC, or they might be getting new market tax credits, which is on the retail side, right?
Sure. You mentioned opportunity zones. Let's touch a little bit about that. I know many of our listeners are going to be familiar with it. Maybe touch on what it is, where it's going, you know, those type of things. Because it is, for some people, a fairly new concept, Dr. Buckley.
Yeah, so the opportunity zones, you know, these are came out of, I think it was the 18, maybe the 20 IRS bill, that Trump put through, and it was really a rider on a bill for all intents and purposes that really wasn't the main thrust of things, but it has become a main thrust. What it basically in a nutshell is taking these zones that each state went through to find census tracts, and those census tracts then were given to the governor of each state, who then pulled, you know, certain separated the kind of, you know, the ones he would keep and the ones they wouldn't keep, and then sent it off to the IRS. The IRS then chose those census tracts. So, you know, you get opportunity zones in some places where it's badly needed in, you know, disenfranchised communities, lower income communities that wouldn't have it otherwise. And then you get some in Ann Arbor, Michigan, right, which is pretty well established, you know, college town, because college students look on the kind of sheet as low income, right? One can have a lot of questions there. But sure. So the opportunity zones, the whole idea with the opportunity zone is to encourage development in communities that would not get development because of, you know, issues of high crime, issues of high poverty, you know, you name it on a demographic perspective, right? And that's the whole idea about it. Yeah.
What's the incentive? Why is someone incented to develop there or do something?
Sure. So the opportunity zone would work this way, where I as a developer would go and do an opportunity zone, right? And I would come in and say, I would float, hey, I need equity, right? So what would happen is a syndicate is put together, people, high net worth corporations, et cetera, that have a high tax bill, okay? From, now this is a thing, a capital gains tax, where they have just cashed in something else. Let's say they had another development they did. They have to replace it. It's, in a sense, if you know the 1031 exchange, slightly modeled off of that.
Okay.
And that's what happens then. And don't quote me on these exact days, but it's somewhere around you have, you then put this into an opportunity zone bundle, right? And you then put it in there. It's a way to kind of avoid paying taxes on the capital gains. You take all that money, let's say you made 100 grand, you know, you'd have 100 grand you're taking out of that and it would be taxed on. You take that 100 grand, you put it into this opportunity zone fund. That fund then has, I believe, 180 days to find a development, right? Now, that is given to the developer, he gets it. The developer then would say, okay, much higher than 100 grand, let's call it a million because that's more realistic. $1 million, right, from this fund that he then takes. He has then, I think, another 180 days to actually break ground. Now, you break ground, that $1 million you have gotten from the opportunity fund is equity on your pro forma, right? Now,
sure.
if you the syndicate, keep it in there for 5 years, it's a 10% reduction on those taxes, those capital gains taxes from before, right?
Okay.
Keeping it for 7 years, you have a 15% reduction on those capital gains. Keep it in all 10 years, your capital gains tax from your previous investment is wiped clean, right? So now that is wiped clean. Now you can pull all that money out of that development. And now you have, you know, more taxes you have to pay on the new capital gains from this development, right? It just acts as normal, everyday equity. You meet your equity partner, you say, I'm going to give you a 2.2 return. You know, you're going to get 22% on your dollar back to you, blah, blah, blah. You know, same type of equity structure, could be a profit structure as well, right, when the deal is sold. So it's a way for developers to go in and do these developments, because the equity people might be scared to do those kind of equity infusion into a development in communities that are a little, you know, not as appealing as others. But this is where
it's an investment. It's a long-term investment opportunity in exchange for a reduction in taxes.
Boom.
That investment becomes the equity for the developer to then really leverage it, and then break ground and actually do the development. Are you seeing a lot of these coming out of that type of model?
Not quite yet.
Okay.
So, but they are starting to pop up. You're seeing a lot of opportunity zones. And if you go through your CoStar, your Moody's Reese, your standard LoopNet, you'll see a lot of listings from commercial brokers that are like opportunity zone, opportunity zone, opportunity zone, right? There's a site I've been looking at in Tampa, which is great in an opportunity zone. And we're just waiting. I'm waiting for, if his numbers get right, my numbers will be right. But yeah, so it is. It's more of a selling point, and they're starting to be developed. There's a ton of money that's being looked at in opportunity zones. And these, and you have, you know, each state really has these opportunity zone funds. You know, Mark Elliott here in South Carolina has a great opportunity zone fund. You know, he would be a great person for you all to talk to at some point, I think.
So for our lenders and banks out there, really familiarizing where they lend, where their state has identified the opportunity zone, looking at the funds that are available and really understanding that market and what opportunities they have to do some lending in that zone?
Yes, I would say that's a good way. And, you know, some of these might actually, from a lender's perspective, you know, help out with some of their, you know, CRA requirements and these kind of things as well. That's those opportunity zones are people are really excited about them. They're starting to come out of the ground. It's a really new program. Like I said, it was the last year of the Trump administration. I believe he put it in. So, you know, 2-3 years old. So it's something that's very exciting for people. You know, so that's something that, you know, people are going to get excited about, because the whole then idea is that you're going to have this economic kind of multiplier effect throughout the community. But, you know, the hindrance from an affordable housing side, excuse me, is that there is no real stipulation that if I was a developer in an opportunity zone, and I got money to do this from an opportunity zone fund, that I had to put in affordable housing or workforce housing. Therein lies the kind of rub, right?
Yeah.
It's more about bolstering up the entire community.
Sure. Well, I think that's great insight. I know there's a couple more areas we wanted to touch on. One is really your work. I know you've done a lot of it in real estate and maybe the effect of climate change.
Yeah.
And whatever side of the spectrum you are on climate change, we do know in the real estate market, it's a lot of talk right now. Can you tell us a little bit more, what's happening with that, or what should we be aware of as lenders?
Yeah, you know, and I can only kind of talk about some of the research I've done in that sense, but there's a lot out there. I just, you know, this is kind of the hanging curveball softball question from Robert, so I appreciate that, because I just gave a paper on this subject last week at a real estate conference in Las Vegas, and I'm submitting it to a real estate journal. I did a survey with Urban Land Institute, which is the big real estate organization for developers in Charleston, South Carolina. Now, Charleston is kind of the it city of much of the South, and you know, cranes everywhere. You can't put up office and multifamily, and for that matter, hospitality fast enough there. But the problem is that the Lower Peninsula of Charleston is flooding all the time. It floods roughly 180 times a year. When king tides happen, you can't get across the city. And you know, by 2100, they're expected a 6 feet sea level rise. And you know, they're looking to go with the Army Corps of Engineers to put in a 1.1 to 1.7 billion, that's with a B, dollar seawall to protect the Lower Peninsula. Now, I went into this kind of talk to see where I could, you know, are developers taking climate change into consideration? Because my whole hypothesis was this, that, you know, your audience, the underwriters of the world in insurance and banking, would be starting to demand that. And what I found out, and again, this is just one study, and it kind of mirrors some of what's happening in the literature out there, is that developers aren't shying away from these areas. And the reason being is, you know, developers have a very small window. They're in and out in 5 years, 5 to 10 years. So they don't necessarily, I mean, I think they care is the wrong word, but they don't put a lot of stock in long-term sea level rise. And neither do what I was seeing down there, you know, the underwriting industry of insurance and banking too, because they're getting in and out of it as well. So it's interesting.
There's still traditional development.
Yeah.
In areas where other people might have concern with climate change, really the infrastructure part of it or the long-term planning is being seen as the role of the government.
Right. No, a lot of these kind of insurance policies then are sold to Fannie and Freddie, who then take it on, right? And so it's interesting. I would have thought going into that there would be more. And I think, you know, your audience here is probably going to be putting more of those kind of constraints on them, because you're seeing that on the 30-year fixed home loan, right?
Sure.
Having them stop insuring, stop funding in single-family homes along coastal zones, right?
And that's, you think it'll move towards maybe the other type of development as well?
Yeah, I think it's only a matter of time, but it hasn't happened yet, which was a shock. Honestly, it was a shock to me. I thought it would have been happening already, but I think it's the way the actual economic structure is of finance versus kind of the living structure. So I don't know, the climate change is interesting in the sense of developers don't seem to care. And when things are put in, and this mirrors some of the stuff that research that's been done in New Orleans and these places. And when it is done, it kind of is more to make themselves look good. Like, I'm not a huge lover of LEED. Design principles, but I think that's mostly been used for marketing for development. So, and I think a lot of it is still happening that way.
So really from an enterprise risk management position or a risk position for a lender to think about where does our stance want to be? Do we think there's risk in this type of development if we're doing extended financing? Maybe what is the short-term risk and is the appropriate coverage there for some of the flooding and movement we've seen?
The word there, Robert, is extended, that you said. If you're doing a short-term construction loan, I don't think you got anything to worry about, right? Do it. Because it's going to be built and it's going to be probably financed by somebody for the permit loan, and they'll get out of it. Now, you know, depending on how long that developer stays, plans on staying into this new structure, you know, permanent loan is then up to, you know, y'all to sit. But I wouldn't, if I was a lender, I wouldn't lend something that was really long term in some of these places, like a Charleston or a New Orleans or Miami for that matter. You know, these are places I would probably be very apprehensive. Now, short term, yes, long term, no.
Well, excellent. Thank you for that insight. As we kind of close out, because I know it's probably more to cover, and we'd love to have you back.
Love to.
I know you're working on a book at the moment on community real estate development. Can you share a little bit about the book and when listeners might be able to see the book in print?
Sure. Thanks for the plug. So we are, you know, midnight hour. It's due to the publisher end of the month. So it's a book on exactly what Robert said, community real estate development, which we call CRED. It's a class I used to teach with the economic development director from Lee County in Florida and the CRA director of Palmetto with the Tampa Housing Authority. And we would teach this over 6 weekends, or actually 7 weekends, but 6 weekends. And it's basically intro to real estate 101, right? It's half USF, was half the USF where I used to teach, and half like people from the community. And the whole gist of this is looking at real estate development that is community driven. So where 20% of your pro forma has to be community driven. And that, you know, that 20% is a vague kind of area. It's meant to be, right? It could be affordable housing, could be a community center, right? It could be any one of these, it could be an artist colony, you know, so forth. And so the idea is we're writing this book on, and it's an edited volume where we'll have a bunch of chapters by academics and so forth, talking about things like, I have a section on LIHTC and opportunity zones. We have the history of community development. We have a section on gentrification, one on financing on how to do it. And then we have a bunch of interviews from the field of people that are actually doing this and how it works and how it differs from standard market rates and so forth. So, yeah, so that's a book that we're gearing really towards, you know, a few communities. One is, of course, the academic community. Another one is a housing authority community where, you know, a lot of housing authorities are shifting from, you know, being building big, you know, managing developments, actually being developers in and of themselves. Of what we kind of talked about earlier, where you have some market rate and some lower income, and also to lenders that are going to be more apt to lending in this world. So yeah, that book should be coming out, I would say, end of spring, early summer.
Well, excellent. We will look for more information on that. Dr. Buckman, thank you so much for your insights and expertise. It's been an absolute pleasure having you today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Great. To our listeners, thank you for allowing us to share some ideas with you. As always, reach out with any questions or comments, and we certainly look forward to hearing from you and having you listen to another one of our podcasts. You know, in summary, we were taking a discussion with Dr. Buckman on the commercial real estate market. First, we know the industrial use market or segment is strong, both in vacant land development and the redevelopment opportunities to service large metro areas where there maybe wasn't as traditional of a redevelopment in industrial. Office space is still up for debate on where it's going. We touched a little on multifamily and where that's going. Some interesting developments around single family rental developments. So you might want to consider that when you're looking at opportunities in your own portfolio. We, of course, talked about the future of retail, maybe the hyper-personalization or the effects of omni-channel on retail space. Dr. Buckman also talked about affordable housing, gave us some insights on opportunity zones, certainly something to think about or look about when you look into when you talk about lending in your own shop. And finally, we talked a little bit about climate change, certainly something that's in the real estate market right now.
You've been listening to Bank on Whitfully. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and tune into the next episode as we feature insights from other leaders in the financial industry and even more ways you can stay ahead of the curve.